welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is part four of Starlin's Willing Executioners, which is a review by Professor Kevin MacDonald of a book called The Jewish Century. The Issue of Jewish Culpability. Alexander Solzhenitsyn calls on Jews to accept moral responsibility for the Jews who took part in the Iron Bolshevik leadership, and even more so in the ideological guidance of a huge country down a false path, and for the Jewish role in the Cheka executions, the drowning of the barges with the condemned in the White and Caspian Seas, collectivization, the Ukrainian famine, in all the vile acts of the Soviet regime. But according to Slezkin, there can be no collective guilt, because Soviet violence, unlike the Nazi persecution of the Jews, was not tribal violence. Violence of the Soviet sort has no legitimate heirs for either the victim or the perpetrators. Slezkin acknowledges that Jews were the most enthusiastic, ethnically defined supporters of the Soviet state, but he essentially argues that Jews were not really Jews when they were communists, at least until World War II caused them to be conscious of their Jewish identities. After all, the legacy of communism was almost as strongly committed to cosmopolitanism as it was to mass violence. Again, we see the importance of Slezkin's claims that Jewish communists lacked a Jewish identity. However, as demonstrated above, there can be little doubt that Soviet Jews thought of themselves as Jews, although they certainly were not religious Jews, and that they worked together on the basis of shared Jewish ethnic identity. Nevertheless, the critical issue for collective guilt is whether the Jewish enthusiasm for the Soviet state and the enthusiastic participation of Jews in the violence against what Slezkin terms rural backwardness and religion had something to do with their Jewish identity. This is a more difficult claim to establish, but the outlines of the argument are quite clear. Even granting the possibility that the revolutionary vanguard composed of Jews like Trotsky that spearheaded the Bolshevik Revolution was far more influenced by a universalist utopian vision than by their upbringing in traditional Judaism, it does not follow that this was the case for the millions of Jews who left the shtetl towns of the Pale of Settlement to migrate to Moscow and the urban centres of the new state. The migration of the Jews to the urban centres of the USSR is a critical aspect of Slezkin's presentation, but it strains credulity to suppose that these migrants threw off, completely and immediately, all remnants of the Eastern European shtetl culture, which Slezkin acknowledges had a deep sense of estrangement from non-Jewish culture, and in particular, a fear and hatred of peasants, resulting from the traditional economic relations between Jews and peasants, and exacerbated by the long and recent history of anti-Jewish pogroms carried out by the peasants. Traditional Jewish shtetl culture also had a very negative attitude towards Christianity, not only as the central cultural icon of the outgroup, but as associated in their minds with a long history of anti-Jewish persecution. The same situation doubtless occurred in Poland, where the efforts of even the most de-ethnicized Jewish communists to recruit Poles were inhibited by traditional Jewish attitudes of superiority towards and estrangement from traditional Polish culture. In other words, the war against rural backwardness and religion was exactly the sort of war that a traditional Jew would have supported wholeheartedly, because it was a war against everything they hated and thought of as oppressing them. Of course, traditional shtetl Jews also hated the Tsar and his government due to restrictions on Jews, and because they did not think that the government did enough to rein in anti-Jewish violence. There can be little doubt that Lenin's contempt for the thick-skulled, boorish, inert and bearishly savage Russian or Ukrainian peasant was shared by the vast majority of shtetl Jews prior to the revolution and afterwards. Those Jews who defiled the holy places of traditional Russian culture and published anti-Christian periodicals doubtless revelled in their tasks for entirely Jewish reasons. And as Gorky worried, their activities not unreasonably stoked the anti-Semitism of the period. Given the anti-Christian attitudes of traditional shtetl Jews, It is very difficult to believe that the Jews engaged in campaigns against Christianity did not have a sense of revenge against the old culture that they held in such contempt. Indeed, Sleskin reviews some of the works of early Soviet Jewish writers that illustrate the revenge theme. The amorous advances of the Jewish protagonist of Edvard Bregritsky's poem, February, are rebuffed by a Russian girl, but their positions are changed after the revolution when he becomes a deputy commissar. Seeing the girl in a brothel, he has sex with her without taking off his boots, his gun, or his trench coat, an act of aggression and revenge. I am taking you because so timid have I always been, and to take vengeance for the shame of my exiled forefathers and the twitter of an unknown fledgling. I am taking you to wreak my vengeance on the world I could not get away from. Sleskin seems comfortable with revenge as a Jewish motive, but he does not consider traditional Jewish culture itself to be a contributor to Jewish attitudes towards traditional Russia, even though he notes that a very traditional part of Jewish culture was to despise the Russians and their culture. Even the Jewish literati despised all of traditional Russian culture, apart from Pushkin and a few literary icons. Indeed, one wonders what would motivate the Jewish commissars to revenge, apart from motives related to their Jewish identity. Traditional hostility towards non-Jews and their culture forms a central theme in the writings of Israel Shahak and many mainstream Jewish historians, including Sleskin, and I have presented summaries of this material elsewhere. An important aspect of Sleskin's general theoretical approach is that relationships between Mercurians and Apollonians involve mutual hostility, suspicion, and contempt, and a sense of superiority. These traditional attitudes were exacerbated by the increase in tensions between Jews and non-Jews, beginning with the pogroms of 1881 and extending with fits and starts into the period of the Bolshevik Revolution. Sleskin's argument that Jews were critically involved in destroying traditional Russian institutions, liquidating Russian nationalists, murdering the Tsar and his family, dispossessing and murdering the kulaks, and destroying the Orthodox Church has been made by many other writers over the years, including Igor Shafirovich, a mathematician and member of the prestigious US National Academy of Sciences. Shafirovich's review of Jewish literary works during the Soviet and post-Soviet period agrees with Sleskin in showing Jewish hatred mixed with a powerful desire for revenge towards pre-revolutionary Russia and its culture. But Shafirovich also suggests that the Jewish Russophobia that prompted the mass murder is not a unique phenomenon, but results from traditional Jewish hostility towards the non-Jewish world, considered trev or unclean, and towards non-Jews themselves, considered subhuman and as worthy of destruction. Both Shafirovich and Sleskin review the traditional animosity of Jews towards Russia, but Sleskin attempts to get his readers to believe that shtetl Jews were magically transformed in the instant of the revolution. Although they did carry out the destruction of traditional Russia and approximately 20 million of its people, they did so only out of the highest humanitarian motives and the dream of utopian socialism, only to return to an overt Jewish identity because the pressures of World War II, the rise of Israel as a source of Jewish identity and pride, and anti-Jewish policies and attitudes in the USSR. This is simply not plausible. The situation prompts reflection on what might have happened in the United States had American communists and their sympathizers assumed power. The red diaper babies came from Jewish families which, around the breakfast table, day after day in Scarsdale, Newton, Great Neck and Beverly Hills, have discussed what an awful, corrupt, immoral, undemocratic, racist society the United States is. Indeed, hatred towards the peoples and cultures of non-Jews and the image of enslaved ancestors as victims of anti-Semitism have been the Jewish norm throughout history, much commented on from Tacitus to the present. It is easy to imagine which sectors of American society would have been deemed overly backward and religious and therefore worthy of mass murder by the American counterparts of the Jewish elite in the Soviet Union, the ones who journeyed to Ellis Island instead of Moscow. The descendants of these overly backward and religious people now loom large among the red state voters who have been so important in recent national elections. Jewish animosity towards the Christian culture that is so deeply ingrained in much of America is legendary. As Joel Kotkin points out, for generations, American Jews have viewed religious conservatives with a combination of fear and disdain. And as Elliot Abrams notes, the American Jewish community clings to what is at bottom a dark vision of America as a land permeated with anti-Semitism and always on the verge of anti-Semitic outbursts. These attitudes are well captured in Stephen Steinleit's charge that the Americans who approved the immigration restriction legislation of the 1920s, the vast majority of the population, were a thoughtless mob, and that the legislation itself was evil, xenophobic, anti-Semitic, vilely discriminatory, a vast moral failure, and a monstrous policy. In the end, the dark view of traditional Slavs and their culture that facilitated the participation of so many Eastern European shtetl Jews in becoming willing executioners in the name of international socialism is not very different from the views of contemporary American Jews about a majority of their fellow countrymen. There is certainly enormity in all this. The 20th century was indeed the Jewish century because Jews and Jewish organizations were intimately and decisively involved in its most important events. Slezkin's greatest accomplishment is to set the historical record straight on the importance of Jews in the Bolshevik Revolution and its aftermath, but he doesn't focus on the huge repercussions of the revolution, repercussions that continue to shape the world of the 21st century. In fact, for long after the revolution, conservatives throughout Europe and the United States believed that Jews were responsible for communism and for the Bolshevik Revolution. The Jewish role in leftist political movements was a common source of anti-Jewish attitudes among a great many intellectuals and political figures. In Germany, the identification of Jews and Bolshevism was widespread in the middle classes and was a critical part of the National Socialist view of the world. As historian Ernst Nolte has noted, for middle-class Germans, the experience of the Bolshevik Revolution in Germany was so immediate, so close to home, and so disquieting, and statistics seemed to prove the overwhelming participation of Jewish ringleaders so irrefutably, that even many liberals believed in Jewish responsibility. Jewish involvement in the horrors of communism was also an important sentiment in Hitler's desire to destroy the USSR and in the anti-Jewish actions of the German National Socialist government. Jews and Jewish organizations were also important forces to inducing the Western democracies to side with Stalin rather than Hitler in World War II. The victory over National Socialism set the stage for the tremendous increase in Jewish power in the post-World War II Western world, in the end more than compensating for the decline of Jews in the Soviet Union. As Slezkin shows, the children of Jewish immigrants assumed an elite position in the United States, just as they had in the Soviet Union and throughout Eastern Europe and Germany prior to World War II. This newfound power facilitated the establishment of Israel, the transformation of the United States and other Western nations in the direction of multiracial, multicultural societies via large-scale non-white immigration, and the consequent decline in European demographic and cultural preeminence. The critical Jewish role in communism has been sanitized, while Jewish victimization by the Nazis has achieved the status of a moral touchstone and is a prime weapon in the push for massive non-European immigration, multiculturalism, and advancing other Jewish causes. The Jewish involvement in Bolshevism has therefore had an enormous effect on recent European and American history. It is certainly true that Jews would have attained elite status in the United States with or without their prominence in the Soviet Union. However, without the Soviet Union as a shining beacon of a land freed of official anti-Semitism, where Jews had attained elite status in a stunningly short period, the history of the United States would have been very different. The persistence of Jewish radicalism influenced the general political sensibility of the Jewish community and had a destabilizing effect on American society, ranging from the paranoia of the McCarthy era to the triumph of the 1960s counter-cultural revolution to the conflicts over immigration and multiculturalism that are so much a part of the contemporary political landscape. It is Slezkin's chief contention that the history of the 20th century was a history of the rise of the Jews in the West, in the Middle East, and in Russia, and ultimately their decline in Russia. I think he is absolutely right about this. If there is any lesson to be learned, it is that Jews not only become an elite in all these areas, they became a hostile elite, hostile to traditional peoples and cultures of all three areas that they came to dominate. Until now, the greatest human tragedies have occurred in the Soviet Union. But Israel's record as an oppressive and expansive occupying power in the Middle East has made it a pariah among the vast majority of the governments of the world. And Jewish hostility towards the European-derived people and culture of the United States has been a consistent feature of Jewish political behaviour and attitudes throughout the 20th century. In the present, this normative Jewish hostility towards the traditional population and culture of the United States remains a potent motivator of Jewish involvement in the transformation of the US into a non-European society. Given this record of Jews as a hostile but very successful elite, I doubt that the continued demographic and cultural dominance of Western European peoples will be retained, either in Europe or the United States, and other Western societies without a decline in Jewish influence. Perhaps, more obviously, the same may be said vis-à-vis the Palestinians and other Arab peoples in the Middle East. The lesson of the Soviet Union and Spain from the 15th to the 17th centuries is that Jewish influence does wax and wane. Unlike the attitudes of the utopian ideologies of the 20th century, there is no end to history. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future at RadioAlbion.com.